Welcome to Keep Calm and Cook On. I'm your host, Julia Tertian. Today, you're listening to one part of a special 9-part series recorded during my virtual book tour celebrating my latest cookbook, Simply Julia. In this series, I get to switch seats and be the person answering the questions rather than asking them. If you enjoyed these conversations, please know that there are over 50 more episodes of Keep Calm and Cook On you might also really love. There's a link to all of the episodes in the show notes, plus a link to order a personalized copy of Simply Julia from Oblong Books, my local indie bookstore. And please don't forget to rate and review the show. It takes very little time and it goes a very long way to sharing these conversations. And before we dive in, a special thanks to Better Than Bouillon, which has made this season and many of my meals possible. Better Than Bouillon is a paste, a base, a flavor enhancer. It's a kitchen shortcut, a secret seasoning. I use it so much that I actually shouted it out in Simply Julia on my list of 5 things I always have on hand. To add more flavor to your meals, head to betterthanbouillon.com or just click on the link in the show notes. Today's episode features the conversation I had with my mother, Rochelle Udell Tertian, on March 7th during a virtual event hosted by Congregation Rodof Shalom, a Reform synagogue in Philadelphia whose history goes back to 1795. Yes, that's 1795. The evening was all about family and food and how both helped me understand my Jewish identity. The event started with me in my kitchen making the coconut marble loaf from Simply Julia, which is an ode to the marble pound cakes that my mother's father made at the bakery he ran in Brooklyn when my mom was growing up. My mother and I were then joined by Ellen Poster, one of Rodof Shalom's congregants. Ellen practiced law in Massachusetts for 45 years. Starting in the 1980s, she represented the LGBTQ community, fighting employment discrimination and helping same-sex couples negotiate the rights and obligations of their relationships when same-sex marriage and domestic partnerships were unavailable. Ellen sought to empower those without a voice to find justice. Ellen is the co-chair of PRISM, the synagogue's LGBTQ connection group, and the Equity, Inclusion, and Diversity Task Force. She's deeply committed to Breaking Bread on Broad, the synagogue's program that distributes essential supplies to their food-insecure neighbors. Rochelle, my mother, in addition to being my mother, had a very long career in publishing and advertising, including roles as the founding art director of Ms. Magazine, the editor-in-chief of Self Magazine, and the SVP and creative director of Chico's. My mom currently creates artwork and community programming and is the busiest retired person I've ever met. It was so sweet and meaningful to have my mom join me on my book tour. We talked about our family, including her parents who I never met, the same ones who ran the bakery in Brooklyn. By the way, if you haven't listened to it already, the conversation I had with Dory Greenspan is a great follow-up to this episode, since Dory grew up going to my grandparents' bakery. My mom and I also had a very meta conversation about how her listening to Keep Calm and Cook On has affected our relationship. I really hope you enjoy this very special conversation.
My mom's parents, my grandparents, ran a bakery in Brooklyn. My mom and her sisters, my aunts, grew up in the bakery. My cousins grew up in the bakery. And I did not. I came along after the bakery, and I have spent most of my life trying in some way to get back to the bakery through asking lots of questions about it, seeing photographs, feeling the sort of tether, the string to it. And this marble loaf cake, when I've asked, you know, my aunts in the past before they both passed away, sadly, when I've asked my mom, when I've asked my cousins, everyone's favorite things, when I've asked other people who know the bakery, you know, went there when they were growing up, I'm always asking what people really loved from the bakery. And the two things that come up all the time in these conversations are marble rye and marble pound cake. Mom, is this factual? Am I telling the truth?
Yes. I mean, people had different special things, but overall, yes, absolutely. Marble rye and marble pound cake. And marble pound cake is very close to babka,
yes,
which is a personal favorite of mine.
Yeah. And part of the reason I love marbled anything is because I love all the flavors and I don't like choosing. And I like anytime two things are intertwined. Like when I get a soft serve ice cream, I want the twist. and it feels very similar here. I also think marbled baked goods are just incredibly beautiful. And I just think that's kind of worth celebrating. Yes, Mom.
you just hit a trigger for me. When Julia graduated college, she was, because of what she did and all of that, she was the speaker at her graduation. And she did a speech about the word, about a word that she learned in her creative writing class. I may screw up the classes and whatever, Julia. But
you're doing great, Mom.
Okay. She actually told a story about being in a class and she was very struck by a poem, and the word in the poem was and. So instead of thinking of the world as or, Julia thought of the world as and. So you could have, and this is me talking, Julia's much more articulate about this, chocolate and vanilla. You could have both. So the marbleizing of this actually triggered that story that you told at your graduation.
No, I'm glad you shared that because I really do love the word and. I think it's really important. I think it just makes the world bigger. And I think we're often forced into decisions that we don't actually have to make. Some decisions we really have to make and are really important. But some, you know, we can have a marble loaf cake. We can have, you know, not all chocolate, just a little, you know, that kind of thing. So yeah, it speaks to something bigger, but it's also just a really delicious and really easy recipe. And I think speaks to a lot of the recipes in this book. And I'm going to walk you through very quickly how I make it. You guys all have the recipe if you want to make it with me. I've measured out ingredients, so I might go a little faster than you, but this is by no means a competition. And I just basically feel like food should never feel competitive in any way. It should feel totally comforting. So I'm going to show you, but you've got the recipe, so you can make it whenever you'd like, or you can just watch.
I go on to demonstrate the recipe at this point, but for the sake of the podcast, I've added a link in the show notes to an Instagram reel I did so you can see how the marble loaf is made. Now, back to the conversation with my mom.
I have so many questions that I want to ask. So many questions, so little time. But you talk in your book, Julia, about cooking and social anxiety. I was wondering if you could tell us how you see the connection between cooking and those kinds of anxieties that we all experience one way or another.
I just wanted to mention before Julia answers that Julia loves coconut. And for her bat mitzvah, we had 13 individual coconut cakes made. So when the candles were put in and people came up to say, to wish her well, there was this parade of coconut. I'm sorry that I distracted from the last question.
Great. I'm happy you added that. I think it's a reminder of, as much as I love simple food, I also love a statement. But yeah, Ellen, to your question, it really ties in so much with what my mom just said. So, you know, the book just came out. I know not everyone, you know, has it or might have it, but what Ellen is referring to is I wrote a ton of personal essays, not a ton, a handful of personal essays in this book. And they talk about things that have a lot to do with healthy comfort food that aren't necessarily tied to an individual recipe. It's just more thoughts about my feelings about, you know, what defines that, what defines healthy comfort food. And one of those essays is about anxiety and cooking. And I think talking about mental health and the intersection of mental health and cooking, to me, it's a very important thing to talk about in a book about healthy comfort food. So some of the things I talk about in that essay are that I have, I don't know, I've always skewed anxious, which is something, you know, my mom and I talk about our anxiety, both our individual and our collective anxiety. This is like a topic of conversation regularly. I don't know if any other Jewish mothers and daughters are listening and identify with this. I have a feeling maybe some do. And in these kinds of conversations, the more I understand about how my anxiety has manifested for me, I know it's very different for everyone, but for me, what I've come to understand about when I feel anxious, I cannot be anxious and present at the same time, unless it's like an intense emergency. And the reason why that was really important for me to understand was because my anxiety is usually me worrying about something that happened that I can't change, or worrying about something that is going to happen. And when I'm present, that's not happening. When I'm in the moment, I'm not anxious. And the reason I'm just talking about that now is because one of the quickest, easiest, and like most daily ways I can access that feeling of being present is when I'm in my kitchen. When I'm cooking, when I'm baking, I get to be so present. And if I am not, it's not the thing I enjoy. I enjoy so much that I get to be so present. And there aren't that many activities that engage all of our senses in the way cooking does. So it gives me access to thinking about, like, you know, I wish you all were here so you could smell, like, the batter smells so good. Like, I can smell the coconut. You know, I can look at this loaf and, you know, the finished product, and like, I can see how beautiful it is. I can, you know, obviously taste it. Like, all these things come in. And those things really help me to be a less anxious person, which I think is valuable. I think also there's other things about cooking that really help me with anxiety, which is connecting with other people. You know, I have a much easier time inviting someone over for something to eat than I do just saying, do you want to hang out? It gives me this kind of access, this way in. And I think cooking for me often, and I know I share this with you, Mom, cooking has also been a really nice way for me to disengage if I'm feeling a little like, this is too much. So maybe like a family holiday thing, my mom and I basically raced to go do the dishes because we both want to step out of the meal just for a minute, you know, to collect our thoughts, to kind of ground ourselves. So I think cooking gives us access to that kind of, you know, time with ourselves when we are with other people. You know, as much as we want to connect, sometimes we have to balance that a little bit, like a marble loaf. You know, we want both.
Rochelle, you told me a story about your bakery where, and it was a story about soup. Do you remember that story about sharing the soup with other people who needed food?
I don't.
It might be the story. Is this the story about your mother, Mom, and
moving the meat in the soup? Yeah, I remember. It was in Russia, where my mother was growing up, and she was the daughter of a baker. That bakery had a little restaurant attached to it as well. And the ovens were quite big. They did mostly baking. And on the Sabbath, people would bring in their pots, a chalant, you know, a stew. And they would put the stew in the ovens to keep warm, because you couldn't cook on the Sabbath until Sabbath was over. They would use the ovens, which stayed warm, even though no one was using them, to keep the stew warm. And my mother, as a young girl, would take the meat out of the pot, not all the meat. She would take a little piece of the meat out of the pots of the richer people and put it into the pots of the poorer people, is what she did in that store. And it was just, you know, so it was, you talk about equity and you talk about helping people out. I don't think anybody noticed. She never got into trouble for it, but it just, for me, it was a place setter in my life about what you could do. So I always remember that very, very fondly about her. She was a little mischievous, but for good reasons.
I was so very touched by that story that I remembered it. And I was just thinking that it was door-to-door, generation to generation, because Julia is so involved with volunteer work and food. And I was wondering if you could share that with us, Julia. Tell us some of the things that you do.
Sure. I would love to. And I think, you know, I appreciate having this kind of background already shared, because, you know, I don't know, something I've been thinking about a lot, because I have the opportunity to do something like this, to be the one that you're all listening to, which is surreal for me. You know, like, I, as much as I love to talk, clearly, like, I really love listening. So I think about the fact that I often get asked to talk about my volunteering and stuff like that, which I'm so happy to talk about because it's such an important part of my life. And I know it's like an important part, that's hard to say, of your community. But I also think, sometimes I think about that, I guess what I'm trying to say is that I would like to be more like my grandmother and not do it to get any pat on the back type of thing. Like, I love these stories about my grandmother, how it was just part of her life. And it was something she did without asking for any permission at all. She just did it. You know, I love thinking about her as a young girl moving meat from one pot to another, like this little miniature Robin Hood, who just didn't ask anyone. I just think that's so wonderful. So I just wanted to share that thought. But yeah, in terms of the volunteering I do, it is just a part of my week. It's a part of my routine. And so for a little bit more context, I know most of you are in the Philadelphia area. I live in the Hudson Valley. I'm about 3 hours from Philadelphia, about 2 hours from New York City. And I used to live in New York City and spent the majority of my life in the city. And before my wife and I moved here, I used to volunteer pretty regularly at God's Love We Deliver, which is an amazing organization based in Soho in Manhattan. And it started in 1985, which I remember because that's also when I started. And they started serving clients who are living with HIV and AIDS. They've grown to serve clients who have over 200 different diagnoses, and within just like the tri-state area. And in the past year, they made close to 2.5 million meals. And they serve not just their clients, but also people around them if they need. So if there's like a single mother going through cancer treatment, and if her child also needs to be fed, like they'll feed the child as well. And they do all of this for free for their clients. I happen to know all these statistics because I just, my most recent podcast episode was all about them. So it's like very much in my head, but I love the work they do. I'm grateful for the work they do, especially because of the direct impact it has and the way it is just so, gives a lot of personalization and dignity to each of their clients. I think that's really important and valuable. So when we moved here, I missed that. I missed going and I missed having a regular volunteer shift. And I looked for something similar in our area. And I was very lucky to stumble upon an organization called Angel Food East, which is based in Kingston, New York, which is like half an hour from where Grace and I live. And we have been going regularly to do a shift every week for, 4 or 5 years now. And it has just been this wonderful part of our routine and a way to connect with a community that we were new to, a way to get to know people in our community, you know, not just to serve our community. And as a freelancer, it's part of why I love volunteering. This was just a sidebar, is it gives me this regular anchor on my schedule, which I really value. It also allows me to always put things in perspective. If I'm ever stressed out or worked up about something, I always feel less so when I leave our shift. I find it very, very grounding and very helpful. And we also do a lot of work with our local food pantry, some other things in our community. But, you know, when people ask me how I found Angel Food East, I think this advice applies wherever you are. I Googled the word volunteer and my zip code. I found different organizations. I called around. I tried volunteering at a few places. And I think finding a regular volunteer shift is like any other relationship. Like, sometimes you have to meet a few different people. you have to find the right fit. And for me, all of this community work I do is completely through food because this is what I love. So this is what I will show up for weekly, you know? So I think it doesn't have to be cooking. If you don't like to cook, that shouldn't be how you get back to your community because you probably won't enjoy it. Like, I think finding something that you are excited to show up for, that you can sustain, and that, you know, in many ways, Mom, that you and I have talked about, like with your mother and things you've done, like things you're passionate about and you would do anyway. I think that to me is the key of just weaving it into your fabric.
So much of what you just said resonates with me so completely, Julia, because we have a program at Road of Shalom called Breaking Bread on Broad.
Yes.
Where we distribute food to food insecure families in our neighborhood. And so it's always on Wednesday. So it's created that same structure for us. Mm-hmm. And we've gotten to know the community, but we've also gotten to know each other, the volunteer community.
Yeah.
So so much of what you said just speaks to me about the beauty of volunteering. But you mentioned in the middle of your answer about your podcast, which is Stay Calm and Cook On. Do I have it right?
Yeah. No, that would be better. It's Keep Calm and Cook On.
Keep Calm and Cook On.
You can call it whatever you want.
could you? I've listened to your podcast, which you can get on Stitcher, and they are so witty and relaxed and wonderful. Could you just talk to us a little bit about that?
Sure. I started my podcast a few years ago. I guess it was like in 2018, and the way I was talking about sort of like anxiety, but using food as kind of a way in. If you really want to talk to people you really like, respect, and admire, but don't know how to start that conversation, I really recommend starting a podcast, because then you can reach out and then you can ask them whatever you want. So that is basically why I started a podcast. I wanted to talk a little bit more deeply and closely with a lot of my colleagues and a lot of people just in and around food who I respect their work and I admire it. And I respect the way they do it. And I just wanted to have these conversations. I wanted to have, honestly, more moments like the one I believe we're experiencing right now, to have a connection that feels, a conversation that feels connected and feels present, you know, all the things we've been talking about. And I found a podcast was a nice medium for that. You know, so much of my work is on the page. So much of my work is about writing and about images and the time it takes for these things to come together, which I love. But I also love with the podcast, it's very immediate. I don't have to wait for it to be printed. And it also means it's a much more accessible format. You know, it's free. You know, anyone can listen, which I think is really amazing. So I like having kind of a mix of mediums. And I also think some things are better talked about than written about, or not better, just, you know, nice. And it's just been really nice to connect with people. So it's now over 50 episodes. I've talked to just a range of people. And one of the best parts of it is, honestly, and I'm not just saying this because you're here, Mom, but I didn't start the podcast so that my mom could listen to it. That wasn't like, my plan wasn't to have some like, I don't know, like passive, like indirect, like plan. But I think in sharing these what have become very like personal conversations with people and sharing them with whoever wants to listen. And I'm very lucky to include my mom as one of my regular listeners. I've gotten to share a lot with you, Mom, that I don't know if it would have come up if, you know, you hadn't listened to the conversation. And it's given me a way to invite my family and specifically my mom into things that I don't know that we would have just talked about if, you know, I mean, my mom and I, we talk often, very regularly, but there are certain things I just wouldn't necessarily think to bring up with you, but I've really loved and enjoyed discussing with you. And it's been one of these things where I feel like with a lot of creative work, sometimes you have a plan, like I make cookbooks. I know that I want them to be, you know, in people's kitchens and used. I want you to have these recipes that I think are really easy and delicious. And the stuff I can't plan or predict is conversations like this that will come out of that. And it's the same with the podcast. Like I didn't go into it with this plan that it would leave me more connected with my mom. That didn't occur to me, but I think in many ways it has. So I don't mean to put you on the spot, Mom, but
it's one of those wonderful consequences that I've appreciated, because I really do feel that you never really know everything about anybody, even those that are closest to you. You just never know. And this was a great way of revealing things that are worth continuing in conversation, which to me has been wonderful.
It's just so evident in this conversation that we've shared that you have this wonderful relationship between the two of you.
One spoonful of Better Than Bouillon's easy-to-use base greatly enhances the flavor of whatever meal I'm trying to make. The reason Better Than Bouillon's flavor is so intense is because it's made with real ingredients: meat, seafood, vegetables, aromatic seasonings. They have a great range of flavors and varieties, including organic, reduced sodium, vegetarian, and vegan options. There's something for everyone and every meal. Better Than Bouillon can be found in the soup aisle at your local grocery store and can also be conveniently purchased online. For more information, visit betterthanbouillon.com or click on the link in the show notes.
When I started really looking at the art in the book, I don't know if you can see, but it's the photos are so very beautiful. Every single photo in the book is like that. And I was wondering how you influenced each other in the creation of art, in the cooking, in the creation of cookbooks, because your fields are interwoven.
Yeah. I mean, I will just say that everything I know about making a book look nice, for lack of better words, I'm all of a sudden very inarticulate. Everything I know about images and the kind of details about design and everything about the way a book looks and feels, all of that I have learned from my parents. So I will let my mom answer this because I don't know how to explain it. You've taught me all of that. So
yeah. I think one of the ways I've learned that you could bring change in the world is to change the way you see something. And I think that if you could present, I think that we've become so much more a visual culture as never before, that today, if you could bring an image that becomes powerful, you know, I spent a lot of time in publishing and in advertising and marketing. So if you could bring an image that quickly relates, I think it would be, it's important. My mother didn't read or write any language. She was illiterate, but incredibly intelligent. And that lesson of growing up in a household where my mother didn't read or write was very important to me, because I've learned to be able to make points or send messages to people that don't necessarily know how to do it. If you're selling products into a Walmart and 10% of their population doesn't read or write English, you've got to use other means to attract them. So I've learned to communicate a little bit, and I think it's a very powerful language to be able to use visual cues to help people get there. So, and Julia does this intuitively. Both Julia and I have a love of common things, you know, that you could find. You don't have to find beauty necessarily in luxury. You can find beauty in a teacup. You can find beauty in the way a napkin falls on a table and appreciate it. The way you could smell the aroma of food cooking or taste it. You can also see and get great pleasure out of just ordinary things that you have in your house.
Mom, so, I have to interrupt you for 1 second. I'm so sorry. I have to interrupt you just to share that of the many things that you and I do talk about and share, we are always saving pieces of cardboard for each other from like packages we get. I'm always like, this is such a good piece of cardboard, or look how beautiful how they pack this. This is mostly what we talk about. So I just wanted to share that. Please continue.
No, I love different textures of things. And I actually do love different forms of cardboard. I know that must sound crazy to people, but one of my jobs when I was growing up in the bakery was my father would give me a stack of unfolded boxes. And my job was to close one side of them so you could use the other side to slip a cake in. And it was set up halfway. So one of my jobs was to make half boxes whole. and stacks of them. That was one of my jobs. So I really began to appreciate, you know, it's like when you open a box and it comes in the mail and it has beautiful tissue paper or a little ribbon wrapped around it. Julia actually sends presents now with bakery string, the red and white string. She ties them up with that, you know, so it's a trigger. It's a reminder. And I also think that there it is. Famous bakery string. It's the thread, the literal thread that keeps us all together.
Good one, Mom.
Yeah. So that's part of the cue. And I really do believe that you can, whether it's choosing the right word as a signal or, smile. If you genuinely smile at someone, genuinely smile, not like a toothpaste commercial. You actually, it's a hello. It's a welcome. And I think those are the kinds of cues that Julia embraces in all of her work.
Mom, can I ask you to share? I'm so sorry, Ellen, I feel like you're about to ask a question.
No, please.
Mom, can you share, because this to me really exemplifies everything you're talking about, and it's one of my favorite stories. Can you share about your mother not reading or writing any language, but basically your start in like graphic design and how that happened with her telephone?
Oh, okay. All right. My mother could read numbers, and she always did the math in the bakery in her head. When you bought something, she could do the math in her head. She could read numbers. And I wanted to provide for her a way of figuring out who to call on the telephone. So I started as a kid drawing on little cards or cardboard or whatever was around a picture of a cake. And then it had the number of the bakery below it, the telephone number of the bakery. So she had that card, or she wanted to reach my sister, who was then married, and it had a picture of my, I drew a picture of my sister and my other sister with a nephew, and they were like little cue card, little cards that would be up there that, so if she needed to, she could reach people because she could read the number. So that's how I worked out this. And I was a little, you know, I just knew that you could find a solution graphically. And I'm a great believer that, you know, these things that we use in graphics should disappear. They should become second to the function. It shouldn't be like you're looking at it and go, oh, that's a great graphic design. It should be, oh my God, that functions so well. And I learned that. Self-taught, I guess. I don't know.
Thank you so much for explaining how you found your way into the art world in such a sort of poignant way to help your mother. I mean, it's just lovely.
I just really appreciate you sharing that story, Mom. And like Ellen said, I think it's just such a beautiful story. And, you know, this idea of using essentially graphic design, which I'm sure as a young kid, you didn't even know what those words meant, but you were doing it from this very, you know, innate place. And I think from this desire to help someone you love do something and connect. I don't know. That just really resonates with me as someone who tries to do that in my work in other ways. And I think also this idea of like the best types of design, you know, my mom is, I know you heard a little bit in her bio, but my mom is really, really good at this. She has like a really amazing background in this and has had so many experiences. And I'm very, very lucky to have both her and my dad at the end of a phone call whenever I need them for what I do for a living, I mean, in general, but especially for what I do for a living, because being able to explain what you want a page to look like before the page exists is a very hard thing to do. My parents have really helped give me this vocabulary, and I really resonate with this idea of like, when it's at its best, you don't know it's there, like it disappears. And to me, that is something that I hope happens in many ways with my recipes, that my hope is that they're supportive enough, they give you all the information that you can make it and forget it was mine. It can become yours. You know, this can be Ellen's great marble loaf that like everyone asked.
It should only happen.
And I think
I plan on cooking my way through the book. I have to tell you. But that that sense of intimacy that, and you refer to yourself as being a cookbook writer for home cooks, and that you see yourself as being a home cook. And you touched on this earlier, but I really wanted to ask you more about it, that you say that it's healthy comfort food. And, you know, we think of comfort food, we think of mac and cheese, we think of mashed potatoes, we think of things that maybe aren't the healthiest things. And so I was wondering if you could talk to us about what does it mean to have healthy comfort food?
Sure. I really appreciate you asking this. And I just want to say before I go on some tangent, which I'm sure I'm about to, that I think macaroni and cheese and mashed potatoes are healthy. And when I say that, what I'm saying is, if they make you feel comforted, if they make you feel taken care of, especially if you're providing that for yourself, to me, that is a very healthy act. And I think
always
it's
feel
really
guilty.
Well, you know, what's really interesting is I wrote a book of healthy comfort food. I wrote a healthy cookbook that has nothing to do with weight loss, that has nothing to do with restriction or deprivation, and has absolutely nothing to do with guilt. And I know guilt is a feeling many of us Jews feel in general, but I think especially when it comes to eating, it's something that a lot of us feel. I know I've felt often. And I have over the years really tried to build a very new relationship to myself and to my body that doesn't really leave any room for guilt or restriction, and to kind of redefine healthy from what I used to understand it to mean, which was just a synonym for thin, for skinny. You know, I equated it with weight loss. And this is something, Mom, you and I have talked so much about, because, you know, I think about how many people feel the same way. And it's because of, you know, seeing pictures and magazines and measuring themselves against them. And I always think, I grew up in a house where, you know, you were making these pages. You know, this is really ingrained in all of us. I know, like, we all live in this very diet culture world. But I feel like I saw it in this very different way at home. So I think this is something we both, you know, work through. And I will say, talking to my mom about this very openly and honestly has been a big, big, huge part about me coming to a much more positive place with it, being able to have like this honest conversation. So for me in this book, I define healthy. It has nothing to do with any numbers, you know, anything to do with calories or anything. It has entirely to do with how we feel when we cook and when we eat. And for so long, I've always felt so happy and positive when I'm cooking. I've always loved to cook. My mom can tell you, since I'm a little kid, I just want to be in the kitchen. I didn't watch cartoons. I watched PBS cooking shows. My mom used to send me I subscribed to Gourmet since I don't know how old I was. And you would send me the copies at camp because I couldn't wait to get home at the end of the summer to read them. Like, I needed to read it in July. And I haven't always felt as happy and as positive when it comes to eating. I've felt very fraught, and I've had a hard time not just like accepting my body, but being happy about it. And I just thought, wow, I can be so happy about cooking. I can love it so much. I can have a curiosity about it. I can have this fearlessness about it. I can not worry about getting something wrong. Like, I feel like each time I get something wrong when I'm cooking, I'm just like, oh, I'm recipe testing. Like, I'm making it better for next time, right? And I just haven't felt that way with eating, and I've really wanted to. So I talk a lot about that in the book. And the way I define healthy in the book, first, I just encourage everyone to define it for yourself. I think it's a word we have to own and define for ourselves because it means something different to each of us. And for me, healthy means freedom. It feels like being free. It feels, when I feel healthy, I feel liberated. I feel connected to what I'm eating, connected to all the people, connected to the ingredients, and most importantly to myself. And I feel just calm and relaxed and not stressed and in touch with what I want and grateful that I get to have it. So that's how I feel.
Thank God. You know, I spent so many years in the magazine business, and I have to apologize for putting lines on the covers of magazines that actually, you know, said things where women had to assume that they had a problem that they never actually had, so that I could present an article where they could fix it. Mm-hmm. So I offer my apologies to many, many generations of of women. I can't take it back. I wish, but I've learned a lot along the way, especially from my daughter.
Yeah. So it's so obvious from listening to Julia talking about going to camp and wanting to have cooking magazines to read. And you said, Julia, that you've always been cooking. It's been in your DNA. So are there any recipes from your childhood, from being in your mom's home and cooking that you'd like to share with us? Like what are the things that you loved growing up?
I thought you were going to ask me if there's anything else I like to do, and I was going to say no, not really. I really thought that's what you were going to say. All of my work, but especially this book, I'm holding my copy because of the marble loaf recipe I needed to refer to. So many of the recipes in this book are childhood favorites of mine. You know, every podcast episode I host, each conversation is different, but I always end each conversation asking everyone what their favorite food was when they were growing up, because it's my favorite question. And I would actually, if you are willing to share, Ellen, later, I'd love to know yours. And I feel like I take this whole book trying to answer that question. There are so many foods I love from growing up. And honestly, I think one of the foods definitely I love most growing up is not a recipe in the cookbook, but it's matzah brei, because mom, it was one of the only things you cooked, and you would make it like on weekends. But there is a recipe for babala, which are like matzah meal pancakes, which is a recipe that was very new to me. I had never heard of it before until you told me about it, mom, because you told me your mother made it. And I just feel like it's worth sharing the photo, if you don't mind. But yeah, there's a whole breakfast chapter. So this is sort of an indirect answer to your question, Ellen, because it wasn't something I ate growing up, but it's something I just feel incredibly connected to. So there, I feel like the best way to describe it is they're almost like the mixture that you would turn into matzo balls, slightly different ratio, but instead of, you know, cooking it in stock or water, or however you make your matzo balls, you take this mixture and use it like a pancake batter. You fry it in butter. So the picture is not of the pancakes. It's of my grandmother, my mother's mother. And I love this picture so much. And I'm so glad it's in the book. But some other childhood favorites, one is in the first chapter, and it's, I feel like we talked, you know, obviously my mom's here, but in the other room next to my mom is my dad. And one of my favorite things to eat when I was growing up was my dad's meatloaf, which he made usually on Saturday night. Because you guys worked during the week, so we didn't really have like family dinner. So Saturday night was our night. And I think all of us, and by all of us, I mean you, mom, me, and my brother, Ben, I think one of our favorite things, all of us, was his meatloaf, which we referred to as Doug's famous meatloaf because it was famous amongst the four of us. And I took my dad's meatloaf and I turned it into a meatball recipe in this book. And it's his Tex-Mex meatloaf. And I just think it's the most ingenious thing. And it's so delicious. And instead of eggs and breadcrumbs, which are typically, you know, the things in meatloaf that stretch out, you know, meat to feed more people and sort of like your mother, mom, my dad substituted a jar of salsa for the egg and then crushed a bag of tortilla chips instead of the breadcrumbs and then added a ton of cheddar cheese to it. And that's it. And it is so delicious. I can't even begin to tell you how good it is. And I make it with ground turkey because that's what my wife and I mostly eat. She doesn't really like red meat. And they're so, so good. And the only reason I turn them into meatballs instead of meatloaf is I'm just really impatient and they cook faster. So that's pretty much it. It's such a good recipe. It's such an easy thing to make. You know, the tortilla chips also make the recipe totally gluten-free, which I know doesn't matter to a lot of people, but does matter to some people. And, you know, if you have celiac disease or anything, meatloaf is something you normally can't enjoy. So this is there for everyone, but including those people. So yeah, those are two recipes that come to mind.
Oh, thank you for that. So I have to say that I've always thought there was a connection between food and memory. And I just have to say that when I was growing up, I'm a Brooklyn girl, and I go to my grandparents' house, my grandmother would always make me matzo meal pancakes. And so for me, the making of them, the taste of them, just brings back my very happiest memories of being with my grandparents, who I loved so much. So I'm so glad that you share that with us.
Well, thank you for sharing that with us. That's really meaningful for me to hear. And, you know, because this wasn't something I had eaten before I wrote the recipe, which is not usually how I write recipes, I really relied on my mom and her stories, which is similar to yours. And mom, you described them to me. I researched some recipes for these. And then you were sitting here, basically where my computer is. I was on this side of my kitchen counter, you know, next to the stove. And my mom was sitting on the other side of the counter. And I, you know, I took out all the ingredients. I made the batter. I think I made one or two that were okay. And then I made one, and I think the ratio was right. I put the plate in front of you, and you ate it, and you said it tastes like my mom, which to me is, I mean, I could burst into tears, but that is the best compliment coming from anyone, but from my mom about her mom is like, blows my mind. So yeah.
That's what I'm saying about this whole conversation. I feel like it's all about generation to generation. You know, that's just such a lovely note to sort of end on. Because we're just about out of time.
Oh my gosh.
And
I have no idea.
We are. It's just flown by. I just cannot thank you both enough for this. Can I use the word enriching, this word delicious to describe this conversation? And I'm just grateful to everyone who was involved in having you be able to be with us tonight.
Thank you so much,
Ellen.
Yeah, it's a privilege being with you all.
Yeah, and meeting you, Ellen, has been such a delightful part of this. And I really, it just reminds me that the minute we start talking about food, we get to know each other. And, you know, Ellen, you, my mom, and I haven't met in person, but, you know, we spoke, you know, once or twice before this. And it's just, I feel like you're part of our family. And I think that's what happens when we have conversations like this. So I really appreciate all of you being here and listening, and mom, for you being here. And can I, Ellen, I'm not sure if you can see on your computer, but I can see on mine in the chat. I just wanted to share some, oh gosh, there's so many more comments. If anyone asked a question I didn't get to, I'm always around on Instagram and stuff if you want to ask me, but I just want to read Beth Packle from the congregation shared a story that I just think, I'm sorry if I'm going over the time.
Thank you so much, Julia, for doing that. I appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. I just want my mom to hear this, because I don't know if you can see it, mom, but Beth shared, which is so sweet. She said, "I could not let this evening go without mentioning my mother, who would have turned 70 today. Sadly, she passed away 2 years ago. Beth, we are very sorry to hear that. Her name was Rochelle, and she was a fabulous baker. I know she would have loved listening to you both. So thank you for sharing your stories, and Beth will make the marble loaf. But mom, I just wanted you to hear that, because I thought that was really amazing.
So sweet. Well, I'm sorry to hear that, but grateful to hear that too. I wish you all a wonderful holiday coming up soon. And Bubala is in the book.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. If you enjoyed it, please take a moment to rate and review the show. And once again, thank you to Better Than Bouillon, which consistently enhances my food, and this special season of Keep Calm and Cook On. One spoonful easily adds the perfect amount of flavor to any of your meals. For more information and to shop, head to betterthanbouillon.com or just click on the link in the show notes. Until next time, take care.